There we are. So, Evan, who are you and what's your relationship with Afghanistan, I guess generally?
Well, I'm the CEO and founder of Black Rifle Coffee, based in Salt Lake, San Antonio, and Nashville. I spent about 20 years, 20 years of combined service between U.S. Army as a Green Beret, and then in the CIA, about 9 years in the CIA. So my relationship to Afghanistan is I spent about 3 years on the ground in Afghanistan working directly with the Afghani, we'll call them the intelligence service for the most part. And then I made the transition to Black Rifle in 2014, and I started trying to reach out to former commandos and intelligence officers that I worked with in Afghanistan. I've been able to hire a few here at Black Rifle over the course of several years. And I've been working with them to not only receive citizenship, but make sure that they're moving through the refugee process correctly, providing English lessons, housing, insurance, vehicles, and things like that.
Very good. Thank you. And from your view, what's going on in Afghanistan? Like, if you could summarize it for us.
Well, if I can summarize it, it's a fairly complex problem, so we'd have to distill it to some simple concepts, which is, Afghanistan has been at war essentially since the 80s. And when we say the 80s, the last time that they had a stable functioning government was prior to the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. So you have to go all the way back to Soviet occupation. At that point, what we were doing as kind of a coalition effort was we were providing support through Pakistan mainly to build militias to fight the Soviets. What that did was we were kind of out of we were disconnected from the way that our dollars were spent in the military support. So Pakistan shaped the environment that the militias were supported. And so they supported who they wanted to through the ISI. The ISI had a very militant group of people that were, we'll call them doctrinally or Islamic. Their Islamic doctrine was on what you would say the more before the Taliban. This was more of a militant version of Islam that was being supported through the ISI. And then that was being funded indirectly through some of our resources, both in weapons and capital. What that did is that created an increase in, we'll call it Islamic extremism to fight the Soviets. We recognized that this was an issue. However, we didn't stop it. Once we defeated the Soviets, they pulled out. It was left to a combination of warlords to fight over the table scraps. The Taliban organized and essentially overthrew, mitigated the rest of the militias. There was one holdout, Massoud, up in the Panjshir Valley. In Panjshir Valley, he was killed on September 11th at the same time that the towers went down, because they knew the Al Qaeda was working directly with the Taliban to orchestrate, obviously, an attack towards America. They knew that they would pull us into an occupation or an invasion of Afghanistan. And they wanted to eliminate some of our guerrilla resources that we were relying on specifically for intelligence and support. So they eliminated Sheikh Massoud, 9, actually 9/12. So it was like within 24-hour period of 9/11. We invaded shortly after with special operations and CIA, and We created essentially, we displaced the Taliban with superior air support and an unconventional military, which was special operations, the CIA, coalition special operations, intelligence services. So we displaced the Taliban. We denied sanctuary. So we accomplished our strategic goal, which was to deny sanctuary of terrorist organizations that would be deemed a threat to the United States. And then we started a nation building process, which was a kind of a half-baked, you know, neocon, neo idea that we can build nations. And when I say that, now I'm getting into more opinion-based things, right? So you have the history of Afghanistan that has been completely war-ridden over the course of, we'll say, my lifetime and probably yours. There's a complete destabilization. There's a lack of infrastructure. There's a rise of Islamic militant organizations that were funded by outside entities. Then we had the hubris to believe that we could come in and raise a democratic republic in a country that has an average education level of, I think, the second grade, with not controlling borders, with not controlling outside influence, without mitigating against, we'll say, Islamic extremism. It's a half-baked plan based on a kind of a pseudo-intellectual political elite class that has no context to history. Nor do they have the ability to do it, because they've never actually been able to succeed in modern history. So now we have is the withdrawal of military forces, U.S. military forces, which in 2012, when I was there, our assessment was the place would collapse as soon as they lost air support and special operations advisors. That hasn't changed. The Pentagon, I would say, you know, not pointing fingers, but the Pentagon and our political appointee military class, the political military class, they have been lying to themselves for 20 years. Okay. And they have been lying to themselves. They've been lying to the administration, administrations. And there's an extreme minority of people that fought in Afghanistan, to include myself, that we knew that the place was going to fold like a house of cards. There's no world I live in where I've ever heard a 2-star, a 3-star, or a 4-star talk to Congress. And every time I've been like, you guys are fucking out to lunch. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why. I don't know how. I don't know if it's the intelligence reporting structure. I don't know if they just want to placate to the crowd, if it's a combination of, you know, I personally think it's a combination of hubris and greed with a political agenda, with a little salt in there that is political agenda that led to this. The Pentagon papers were released, or the Afghan papers were released in what year? Do you remember?
Was that 17 or 18?
Yeah. They had a very proper assessment. So they knew what was going on. I think they knew what has been going on, and their assessment was basically, this is a failed endeavor that was never published to a large degree. It was politically placated. We did another, you know, round of surge. But there's no reality that the warfighter has lived in the last 20 years that the Afghans could defend themselves without American air power.
Gotcha. Okay. And moving on, because we only have a couple minutes left.
Okay.
So the Afghan interpreters, who our forces, U.S. military forces, have worked with for 2 decades with at this point, what is their situation? What was your experience working with them?
Well, I got a little bit more time. So
Okay.
The situation is, and we have to back this up, we have to go a little bit further back, which is knowing that this is the situation, which is there's a saying in the military, plan for the worst, hope for the best. We always knew, meaning every person that fought the war over there knew that this was a possibility once we started a withdrawal. We had modern representation as to how our nation building process went. So if we just go back within my lifetime to Iraq and say, okay, once we downsized and withdrew out of Iraq, what happened? ISIS essentially moved out of Syria. They went through, you know, the West, and then from the North all the way through Mosul, and almost got to the banks of, we'll call it, Baghdad. So we know what's going to happen. It's astounding to me that, without getting too emotional, but when you know this is a possibility based on modern historical fact and your personal and professional experience, you have to prepare to evacuate not only your people, but the people that have fought to your left and right and been your direct support structure within the country, because those people will be targeted by our enemy, which is, when I say this is like a fourth grade concept. So you don't need 4 stars to understand this, which is, when your enemy is the only probable course of action to overthrow the government and coalition allies will be targeted for prison, torture, execution. They will be mitigated within the entire government infrastructure. And not only will they be marginalized, but they will be punished. And the failure here is to not live in a reality where we take care of our allies and the people that have continued to take care of us for 20 years. We owe them that. It's an ethical obligation. So regardless of political rhetoric, it is an ethical obligation to protect the people that have protected our people for 20 years. And they didn't process the special immigrant visas. They didn't align a process that would at least provide coverage for the ANA for, we'll call it, in another 180 days to 365, because they wanted the political point that they were withdrawing troops from Afghanistan. That's what they wanted. So you can't do that until you protected your people. This entire shit show is completely avoidable. All they needed was the ability to continue to have air support and special operations advisors. When I say that, with a special operations advisor footprint and air support, to make sure that we can do a proper withdrawal. So even from the tactical perspective on the ground, you do not withdraw without cover. You have to cover. Like, it's a basic concept, which is, if you're going to move and withdraw from a firefight, you have to have coverage while you're withdrawing until everybody is off, we'll call it the X. It's no different on a large scale country capacity. We've been in an active, engaged firefight with the Taliban for 20 years. How is it that nobody understood what was going to happen? Because there was every E4 that's ever fought in Afghanistan, E4 meaning a kid that's probably on the average age of 22 with it just above a high school education, knew that was going to happen. So how is it that supposed professional diplomats, and we'll call it diplomatic elite military officers, didn't understand that? I'll tell you why. Because they've been disconnected from the reality of war for 20 years, sitting in fucking boardrooms with, you know, pressed uniforms and thick fucking coffee tables, drinking, you know, Perrier, talking about how it's like to fight a fucking war, and they're asking the right questions, because they're not war fighters. They're empty suits that continue to espouse political ideology that has been failed over and over and over again. We can't fight a war with political correct agendas. We can't have attorneys involved in deciding what our ROE is going to be. War is inherently politically incorrect. You can't have those two things in any world that we live in. We can't go and defeat terrorism and nation build without killing a fuck ton of people. That's the way it works. So sorry, American public, but we can't do that unless we hold Pakistan accountable for their actions. We can't do that unless we hold the international terrorist organizations accountable in every, you have to deny sanctuary, economic sanctuary, like ideological sanctuary. Everything has to go. You have to roll it all up. If you don't do that, this is what happens. You have Islamic extremism or extremism in any way take over, because we have this idealistic, inaccurate image of ourselves and what we're capable of doing. And it's not fucking reality. It isn't.
Understood. And could you maybe provide a personal account of your time with Afghan interpreters?
I mean, I've had multiple linguists. You know, that's what they're called, linguists. So you can call them interpreters. You can call them terps. Like, you know, that's what happens is, like, when you call them interpreters, it's inaccurate representation. They're linguists. But I think my experience goes back to my first trip in Afghanistan was 2007. And the linguists have a very important mission. They have to, one, communicate directly with, we'll call them the military advisor relationship, which is now we're training. So if we're selecting and training Afghans for war, they have one element of that, right? Then you have the interpreter or the linguist that's also out in the war. So they're also moving out into the war zones in direct conflict, meaning they're right with the platoon, the company, every one of us, as we're fighting left and right with the Taliban, and they're helping direct our Afghan counterparts as we're actively engaged. So they're putting their asses on the line, not only for a year, right? So when you do a rotation over there, it could be 3 months to a year, depending. Those are the guys that are continuing to go out year after year after year. So they're engaged in direct combat year after year after year that we've been there. They are to the left and right of the command element structure and every one of those engagements, especially if we have embed ANA forces or Afghani forces. Then if we're, we'll call it going house to house or doing direct action, they're on target, both female and male, female and male, which is important. They're talking to civilians. So they're deconflicting any misinformation that's been put out on the, you know, directly in reference to Taliban putting out misinformation against the American military. They're de-escalating certain events. So they're talking to the women, the children, the men, everybody to de-escalate the situation that might, you know, could, especially when you're killing people. I mean, obviously you can imagine the emotional aspects of that. So they're on the front lines every day and have been on the front lines every day with the American service member, and multiple rotations. When I say multiple rotations, year after year, these guys have been putting their asses on the line. And not only that, but there's a representation by the United States military and the State Department that if you serve with us, you will be at least appreciate, we will appreciate that by expediting your visa process to the United States. So not only is it, it's not an implied aspect of things, it is a stated fact that commanders and other people of, we'll call them political authority, depending on CIA, military, that is used as a carrot on the stick to keep these guys constantly engaged. That's also a very important fact. These guys are putting their asses on the line with the expectation that if they do that, they will probably receive at least a refugee or a ask or an invite that their visas will be processed so they can come to the United States.
Understood. And about that, there are some, interestingly, both on the right and left elements that are concerned about the vetting of Afghan refugees, especially the linguists. So do the linguists get vetted before they ever become a linguist, where we know who they are and their backgrounds already? And so a secondary vetting process would be redundant.
Yeah, it depends. It depends on who they are and where they're coming from. So obviously, if you have a, we'll call it a CIA linguist that's going to be working with you, more than likely that person has had a background check. He's got multiple different recommendations from multiple different people. You understand the network. You understand the people that he's directly connected with, his family members. More than likely, they've spent some time. They've probably taken a polygraph. So they have, a lot of these guys have security clearances. So if they're working for the State Department or the CIA, they have security clearances, which means they've already had a background check, which means they already had a background check that is much higher than 99.9% of any civilian in the United States. So now as you get into the military and you get into the conventional military and large scale military, I'm not as familiar with that vetting process, but I think that the concern should be right now is building the the concern should have been, we've had 20 years to get our act together and vetting these guys to make sure that when the day comes, because when you're occupying a nation, it's not a matter of like whether or not you're going to leave. You're going to leave. Like that's right. You're going to. So this should not be a surprise to anyone. The planning process in this, like we have been frustrated, when I say we have been frustrated with this for years. The State Department has failed every year. If they failed in Iraq, they failed in other countries we've been involved in, and they fail in Afghanistan. When they fail to process the applications on time, they fail because there's bureaucracy and political layers of bullshit that we have to continue to go through. So even if I have 20 guys that are former special operations guys that have gone out every night with some of these dudes, they've done thousands of targets with us, that would actively give their life any day for ours, and that probably love this country. When they say love America, they love America. I have a hard time, and I've had a hard time trying to get those visas pushed through. So when I say the process of, you know, vetting, we've had 20 years to get that vetting process done. This is not a problem right now. When I say this is not a problem of, oh, well, we need to make sure that these guys are vetted. The problem is why are we trying to do this now? We've had 20 years. Like, we can't do this as a nation. So what we have to do is we have to build a system that is just as, when people say, and it pisses me off, so I mean, I'll be fine with being like frank and a little bit crass, which is like, You want sanctuary for people that are crossing the border into the United States with little to zero vetting from the left. Mm-hmm. But because I think there's a big social disconnect because there isn't a lot of Afghanis in the United States. There are a lot of Mexican Americans in the United States. There are people have a context and understanding of to the culture, the people, but there's a very, very small percentage of people in the United States that have any direct reference with, we'll call them Afghani citizens. And I think there's a very inaccurate representation. I think that most of these, or that part of these people would be, you know, part of a terrorist organization, or they'd be dangerous to the United States. I'm not saying none of them would be, but I'm saying now it's going to be much more difficult because the Taliban is in control of who is leaving. 2 months ago, we were in control as to how do we vet people? How do we put people on manifests? How do we get people out of country? Now the Taliban's in control. So of course this is going to be much more complicated. And of course that is something we have to mitigate against. And now it's going to take even longer to process the backgrounds because these guys are in charge. So 2 months ago when we were in charge, I think it would have been much easier to do backgrounds, to process applications, to get, you know, proper vetting. Now, how are we going to do that? So it is a concern. It should be a concern. I think that they could build a structure where they have multiple different countries that are willing to take Afghan refugees. And, you know, this is political asylum.
Mm-hmm.
They're going into, now Afghanistan will be under a, you know, a fascist theocratic regime. This is political asylum. That's what it is. And it's, yes, it's refugee status, but like, I mean, good God, these people are going to be in such a horrible circumstance. The international community should be reaching out saying, who wants to leave the dark ages? How do we do that? So I think that at the end of the day, we could process people in a very efficient way if we were moving them from, we'll call them, you know, Afghanistan to Uzbekistan or Tajikistan. So it's a reverse logistics situation. Just like we went in, we have to pull out. Mm-hmm. And so if we've got at least a system of vetting that is logistically reversed from the way that we went in with special operations, and now it's, well, we got to bring the Afghanis out. And we are going in through Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, in some cases, depending on it, Iran. And if we would have had air bases there that were active, this would have been much more easy to accomplish, right? So the problem isn't necessarily with, yes, we know that there will be bad actors, which I think will be an extreme minority of the applicants. Now it's going to be much more complex. And now we have to build a much more complex system to safeguard the country and make sure that we're doing proper vetting while getting enough people out for political asylum.
Gotcha. And last question. This morning I saw the Taliban had a press conference, which is just crazy to think about, but saying that they would not be doing reprisals, that women's rights would not be violated according to Muslim law. Is there any reason to believe them?
No. Okay. Like there's zero reason to ever believe them in any circumstance, in any even parallel universe. There's zero believability. If all we have to do is look back in time and say, how did the Taliban, because if we remember, the Taliban, this isn't the first time they've been in charge of Afghanistan. So when we look at, you know, people that are instituting the Sharia law, because that's ultimately what it's going to be, in a very extreme version of Sharia law, then it's women will be required, you know, facial coverings at all points in time. There will be a direct relationship between power that will shift. There will be no females in any position of authority across the United States. So if we want to talk about women's rights, the Taliban is not going to be the representative organization for women's rights, because they have a historical track record of abuse towards women and children, by the way, because they're also, these guys are not only, when I get, you know, rolling here, but, you know, it goes against every portion of what they believe. This is propaganda that they're putting out into the international community that is directly related to how they're perceived in legitimate, we'll call it legitimate governments. And then when they do that, they've been able to have at least a cover, because there will not be any media allowed access in there. We can look at how they ran the country before we were involved. There's no media in the country. You couldn't have radios. You couldn't have TVs. You couldn't have phones. Women were beaten with sticks in the streets for not adhering to dress code. Men were beaten with sticks for not having beards. Like, these people are sick. And for anybody to believe that they're not going to have reprisals against Afghani government officials or people, like, they're completely out to lunch on this stuff. And I think that the international community really has to decide at this point, what is acceptable. I really do, because they're going to go back into the dark ages. Afghanistan is going to go back into the dark ages. And there are a bunch of very intelligent, educated people that will be stuck in the dark ages under a theocracy. It worse than Iran. Worse than Iran. This is such an evil version of government. It's so disgusting. I have such profound empathy for the people, because I fought against these guys. I understand that they're completely, for lack of a better term, these people are crazy. They're crazy. And they're reversing the international community in the context of they want to take their country back in time. They believe in these circumstances where they have the caliphate and, Sharia law. Their version of government and religion is, wow. When I don't even have words for how evil this thing is. So there's no reason to ever believe them in any circumstance. There's no reason. So I don't know. I don't know how else I could answer that.
No, that was sufficient. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So what I'm going to do is get this interview into text. And I will send you an audio file of this. Okay. So you have it for your records. And I'm going to stop recording now because it